vectors and spin forms, it is in terms of local fields, in terms of a quantum field theory with topological defects. And my interest, my motivation for looking into this is that it gives a new perspective, a new understanding of what is the main assumption behind loop quantum gravity. It gives a new answer to the question, why loops? In fact, as you know, loop quantum gravity can be understood as general relativity plus quantum mechanics plus a technical assumption that is about loops. And once you make this assumption, you get a mathematically robust quantum theory with a rich Planck-scale quantum geometry, discrete spectra and non-commutative operators. And there's evidence that you get that you recover general relativity in the classical limit. And all these results, not just from GR plus quantum mechanics, there's also this assumption that is what's been introduced as the loop representation in 1988 by Rovelli and Smolin. And this leads to new methods and new mathematics. This gives, you know, the path integral, the functional measure is something that really is mathematically well-defined. This is one of the rare cases where you get a mathematically well-defined measure, the Hershkovsky-Lewandowski functional measure. Now, this is one formulation of this assumption. There are others, in particular one that is the one mainly used in spin forms, that is start with a discrete classical theory, the one mainly studied by Laurent Fredel and Simone Speziale that goes under the name of twisted geometries. Quantize this classical theory, and you get spin forms. Now, in this talk, I won't present a new formulation, a dual formulation, and I start with a classical theory, a classical field theory with local fields and topological defects. This is a classical theory, and what I want to show is that when you quantize it, you get the Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity, and there's the perspective of defining the dynamics within this language. And this is a set of ideas that have been around for a while. The version that I'll describe is the one that is in this paper of mine. The idea is quite simple, so I'll try to describe it in just one slide and then go into technical details. So let's start with a manifold, a three-manifold representing space. And erase from it just a line. This will be one of my defects. Now you know that this manifold is not simply connected, and if you consider a locally flat connection on it, up to gauge transformations, this is described by just one parameter, the modulus. And this parameter is captured by the Wilson loop around the defect. So we're going from a configuration space of connections that is infinite dimensional to one that is finite dimensional, just one dimension, once you impose local flatness. Similarly, if you consider a network of defect lines, defects that can intersect, we'll get many but a finite number of degrees of freedom. Now, this is a classical system. I've described the configuration space. You can get a phase space out of it, quantize this classical system, and get an Hilbert space that turns out to be the one of loop quantum gravity, the sector associated to a graph. So this is the space of states, and then one can ask, can we define the dynamics on this space of states? And the idea is that if you consider local interactions of defects with some properties, for instance, locally Lorentz invariant and diffeomorphism invariant, you get a topological theory that has many degrees of freedom. And the question is if this theory admits a regime that can be effectively described in terms of general relativity. Now, what is the physical interpretation of this assumption? A question? Yeah.
I'm sure you have something to say
about that. I'll discuss this in the second part. Okay. And I agree it's about changing graphs, the dynamics. So about the physical interpretation of this assumption. What does it mean to have a locally flat connection? That the field strength of this connection is zero everywhere in the bulk of this manifold with the boundary. The boundary is the defect. But the field strength in three dimensions is just the magnetic field. So you have a magnetic field that is zero everywhere. Well, except on the defect. This is like a solenoid that has a flux of magnetic field inside it. So the setting is very similar to the one of the Aronbaum effect. And you know that classically you cannot probe this magnetic field is confined inside the solenoid, if you consider a charged particle that doesn't enter the solenoid. But quantum mechanically, you can measure it. In fact, this interference experiment, interference pattern depends on the flux of the magnetic field in a specific way. The shift of the peak depends on the flux of the magnetic field. In fact, depends only on this quantity, the Wilson loop, around the solenoid. This is, in fact, the shift of the wave function that leads to this effect. Now, similarly, what I'm giving as interpretation of this assumption is that loop quantum gravity, we're assuming that the microscopic degrees of freedom of gravity, both at the classical and the quantum level, are gravitational connections with distributional magnetic field, supported on these defect lines. Once you make this assumption, this is a system with a finite number of degrees of freedom that are completely captured by Wilson loops. And in fact, these are captured by Wilson loops in a different variant way. If you deform this loop, if you deform the trajectories of electrons here, you would get exactly the same effect because it does not depend on, it remains the same if you continuously deform the loop. So this is a diffin variant truncation of general relativity. General relativity has infinite number of degrees of freedom. We are describing a finite number of them. But it's a truncation that is not an ultraviolet truncation, nor an infrared one. OK, so this is the main idea. Now I'd like to give some the mathematical formulation of this, the Hilbert space. I'll mainly focus on the space of states and show how from defects, line defects in space, you get spin networks. And then the second part will be about the dynamics, about how changing defects gives dynamics, or equivalently considering not line defects, but surface defects in space-time gives spin forms. So the first part, let me start from classical general relativity, from the kinematics of general relativity in Hashbeck-Barbero variables. You know that the configuration variable is an SU2 connection on a free manifold. And the metric is coded into the momentum conjugated to the connection, the electric field. Now, the standard all canonical quantization amounts to consider an Hilbert space of functionals of this connection, functionals that are invariant under SU2 gauge transformations and diffeomorphisms. And we know that implementing this quantization is difficult. In fact, if one stops there, it's only formal. This is a theory with an infinite number of degrees of freedom that's not clear how to treat. In loop quantum gravity, one manages to define mathematically this theory adding this extra assumption. And here I'm describing this assumption in the following way. I'm adding one extra ingredient that is, instead of considering the three-manifold sigma, consider a three-manifold sigma prime that is not simply connected because there are boundaries and line defects, and do the canonical quantization for this theory with the extra requirement that you have topological invariance in the bulk of sigma prime. That is, field strength applied on states is zero. And this is what I'm going to give a sector of the Hilbert space of quantum gravity, the sector associated to graphs that are dual to line defects in a precise way that I'll describe. So the way is the following. So space, three manifold. Let's assume that has trivial topology. And now let's consider a cellular decomposition of this manifold. For instance, a triangulation. Don't have to, but just to choose a case. And now, once I have this triangulation, I can erase the one skeleton, these lines, from the manifold. And what I get is a new manifold that I'm calling sigma prime that has non-trivial pi 1, non-trivial homotopy group, this homotopy group. And as we know, I should introduce now, as I was saying before, locally flat connections on this manifold. And these connections have field strength zero everywhere, or equivalently have magnetic field supported on this skeleton. And as we know, now there's a large mathematical literature on this. Modulo gauge transformations, this space of configurations is finite dimensional. It's in fact a compact configuration space known as moduli space. and is described by homomorphisms from the pi 1 of this manifold to SU2 modulo gauge transformations. And I'll call coordinates on this moduli space moduli, M1 MR, dimension R. And the phase space is given by the cotangent bundle to this. Now, this is classical, and already at the classical level you see a fissure. Going from an infinite dimensional configuration space to a finite one, where the moduli space is compact, these moduli M live on intervals. So in the quantum theory, the conjugate momentum P, we have to expect that it will have a discrete spectrum. But P is momentum conjugated to the gauge invariant part of the connection, the electric field. The T and this variable is the metric. So you have to expect that in this theory, the metric will act as an operator with a discrete spectrum. All this is classical. Now I go to quantum. Want an Hilbert space. So I first introduce a linear space of functionals at the connection. So functionals of A that are gauge invariant, and the connection is restricted to be locally flat. Locally flat connection can always be written as some connection in a certain gauge conjugated via G gauge transformations. And the gauge fixed connection depends only on the moduli. So you get that these states, these functionals of the connection, reduce to ordinary wave functions. They are gauge invariant. You can change variables, and you get just an ordinary function. So you are going from a functional Hilbert space, from a functional L2, to an ordinary L2 space of integrable, square integrable functions on a moduli space. Let me give just an example. Let's consider a loop, for instance, a loop that encircles one of the defects. And you can associate a state to this loop, the Wilson loop. Now, this depends on the embedding of the loop. But in fact, it turns out that it depends only on the knotting of the loop with the defect network. In fact, this function, psi, small psi, the wave function, is independent of the continuous deformations of the loop. And the reason is why, the reason is that here you have that the field strength in this region is zero. So deformation will not change the wave function. So invariance under diffeomorphisms follows from gauge invariance and topological invariance. So these states are actually gauge invariant and diffeinvariant. Yeah, Wilson loop are diffeinvariant states. At this equality.
Are the Wilson loops all the states, or are there some states like the Stern-Simon invariant which are not decomposable in Wilson loops?
Yeah, they are all the states. They generate the Hilbert space, as I'll discuss in the next slide. Chern-Simon states will not appear here. Chern-Simon states would depend also on the self-knotting of these loops.
Right.
They will not appear here. They would appear if I consider a different topological theory, not of the BF kind, but of the Chern-Simon's kind. So you can expect that in this formulation, I will get spin networks. And spin networks with links that are knotted are equivalent, are in the same equivalence class. OK, so these are wave functions. But I want an Hilbert space. And what I need is a scalar product. And I'll introduce the scalar product in the standard way. By standard way, I mean the same way that you have to define this functional integral. Functional measure is the problem. We don't want to define it in a formal way. We want something we can compute. It turns out that there's a class of cases where you can actually do it. And these are, in particular, the cases where it reduces to an ordinary Lebesgue measure. There are examples, for instance, the string measure, when you treat it. And here I'm treating it in the same way, a Lapolyakov. Another example is the way you treat 2 plus 1 gravity with point particles. There's a treatment by Carlip that uses exactly the same language. And it has been developed also for the simplicial measure. So what I'm doing is this. I want to define this functional integral of connections that are locally flat modulo gauge. So I can write them in this way. Now I can gauge fix the connection. So what I get is an expression in terms of gauge fixing chi and the Fadier-Popov determinant. This is standard. But now the gauge fixed connection depends only on this moduli. So I can change variables. So I go to an expression that is in terms of R variables, a finite number of variables. J is the Jacobian from A bar to M. The Fadier Popov determinant is the Fadier Popov determinant that we are familiar with. So we get a measure, a moduli space, that here I'm calling the quantum field theoretical measure, because I'm not adding extra assumptions. It's just the standard definition of the measure. The new thing is that here is non-perturbative. It's not ordered by order in perturbation theory. And I can do it because we have finite number of degrees of freedom. OK, so you get a measure. But now the problem is computing this Fadier-Popov determinant. This, in general, is very difficult. In fact, in all these approaches, it turns out that you can do it in special cases, not in the most general case. For simple topologies, or as an undergraduate, in my master's thesis, I studied these kind of approaches where you try to define the simplicial measure for Legge gravity in a way that is diff invariant because you are using are determining a measure of this kind. And there, too, it turns out that you get a complete description in two dimensions for triangulations. But already in three dimensions, you can get this Fadier-Popov determinant only in special cases for some simple triangulations. Here, there's something new. There's an advantage that comes from the fact that we have a gauge group. That means that you can guess and check, or you can easily obtain this Fadier-Popov determinant using just group theoretical methods. And this is what gives the link with loop quantum gravity. Somehow, loop quantum gravity has this advantage of having this local group that allows to determine completely this Fadier-Popov determinant. So to do this, I have to go into some details. It is what is the dual graph I was speaking about before. So the aim is to define this Fadier-Popov determinant. But to define it, well, it is defined. I want to show a way to compute it. And, and in doing this, I'll show also what is the relation with spin networks, how spin networks arise in this description. OK. So wave functions and spin networks. So this is my construction. I started with a triangulation, with a certain cellular decomposition. Once you have a triangulation or a cellular decomposition, you can introduce a dual graph. It is a graph with a node in each cell and a link connecting two cells if they are adjacent. So this is my notion of graph that is dual to the cellular decomposition. And now there's something interesting. You know that if you go to the defect network now, turns out that the H-path group of the graph is isomorphic to the first homotopy group of this manifold with defects. And similarly, the moduli space N that before I was describing in terms of homomorphisms of this pi 1 can be described in terms of homomorphisms of the H-path group to SU2 modulo SU2. But now I'm immediately in the variables that we are familiar with in loop quantum gravity, because I can associate two generators of this pi gamma holonomies, in particular spin network states that are these cylindrical functions, these functionals of the connections or the connection that are labeled by the graph gamma that is embedded. This is an embedded graph now. And a function from SU2 to DL to C, invariant under gauge transformation at nodes. And here, HL is the holonomy along a link of this graph. So this is one specific functional of the connection. These functionals generate the Hilbert space. And they are diff invariant. If you continuously deform this graph, again, as before, you get that the state is invariant. It is only sensitive to the knotting of the graph with the defects. And another remark that is important for the following is that there is this gauge invariance at nodes, this lattice gauge invariance. You can gauge fix it, for instance, choosing a maximal tree. And what you get after gauge fixing is a function of the true degrees of freedom. It is a function of moduli. So this spin network wave functions reduce to ordinary wave functions in moduli space. Yeah.
So you get the Hilbert space of spin network states on the dual graph.
Yeah.
Is that right?
That's right. Exactly.
What about the J?
The spins?
No, the Jacobian from changing variables is a measure to the moduli.
Yeah, I'm gonna show it now. So now that I have these spin networks, these wave functions, there's a natural measure that I can introduce on them. That is the one used in lattice gauge theory and the one used in loop quantum gravity. That is just the R measure on each link. And as I was saying before, you can gauge fix the invariance at nodes. And what you get is that this product of R measures on SU2 reduced to a measure on a moduli space. This, in fact, has a name, is the value integration formula. So you get this measure, omega of MR. This is easy to get. It's not as difficult as the Fadier-Popov determinant. It's not the determinant of some functional differential equation. And the statement is that the loop measure, this one, coincides with the quantum field theoretical measure, the one given by J times delta Fadier-Popov. And the reason for this is the relation between the combinatorial and the analytic torsion. Now, instead of going into the details of the proof of this, I want to show one simple example where I can do all the computation up to the end and show that I get the same result. So the example is just a single length effect. And the dual is a single loop, a single whistle loop. Okay, first the classical part, as always. So I'm speaking about the manifold with clear topology, and I erase a line. The locally flat connection is the familiar one, this one in the Coulomb gauge. And you see it's completely described by this parameter, phi I. In fact, up to gauge transformations only by the modulus of phi I. And the holonomy along a loop that n circles n times the defect is a gauge invariant. Well, if you take the trace, it's a gauge invariant quantity. The n is the winning number. Now, what is the physical meaning of this phi? Now you see it is exactly the flux of the magnetic field through the defect. So you change your magnetic field in the laboratory, and you change this Wilson loop. This is classical, and now we are considering this as our configuration variable. And you see also that the moduli space, it is the one defined before, just reduces to a single parameter on an interval, 0 to pi. And Wilson loop states reduce to an ordinary function, the cosine of pi. Interval, conjugate momentum to phi, you can introduce it. Look at its spectrum, it's discrete. Just a comment at this point. Okay. Now the measure. So first the loop measure, then the quantum field theory measure. Loop measure is the easy one. I simply have to start with the R measure and reduce it to this phi, what is called the class angle. And here I'm saying it's the flux of the magnetic field. Well, I will do this calculation. It's sine square of phi half, 1 over pi in integration range from 0 to pi. Immediate. On the other end, the quantum field theoretical measure, well, I have to compute these two quantities. The first one is easy. It's the Jacobian from gauge fixed connection to flux. So it's from a three-dimensional vector to its modulus, phi square. Done. J phi is phi square. The second is the Fadier-Popov determinant. Now, this, if you take it alone, is gauge dependent. It's the product of the two, this gauge invariant. So I'm computing it into the gauge, the Coulomb gauge introduced before. I have to compute first this operator and then compute its determinant. The operator, you can write it. It's, by this differential. It's this differential operator. And you can compute the eigenvalues. Well, you can actually do it. They depend on phi on the flux in this way. Now we have to compute the determinant of it. As always, we have to define it. We can define it via zeta functional regularization as the product of the eigenvalues regularized. You get this expression, and you look at it, and you realize that this is the product expansion of the sine phi over phi. So sine phi half over phi half square times phi square. The constant is determined by fixing the measure to 1. You get the same thing. Clearly, this is complicated, but has a strong physical meaning. We are assuming something clear. We are assuming locality. if you assume locality, local fields, you integrate over local fields, and you assume exact gauge invariance, you can determine this complicated non-local measure. And the reason I like it is that we are not adding an extra assumption in the definition of the measure of the scalar product in quantum gravity. This really follows from the symmetries of the theory. This is something that is stated. This is something that when one speaks about the Eschterichar-Lewandowski measure, one proves this result. And the thing is that we are proving it using standard methods, familiar methods. Okay, so this was the illustration in a special case, and this is all about the first part. And I'd like to tell you something about the dynamics, how this speaks with the dynamics. And in fact, it turns out that this is very much related to spin forms and the way we understand spin forms. So I'm
can
not really.
Can you introduce a word in yeah. general? Because in some sense, you downplay that. It's unusual to convert, you just postulate that measure and you show, it's related to a continuum measure. So now, in general, this equivalence between these two determinants, you're saying this is the equivalence between the two torsion?
Yeah.
So where is it done? Where done this? Is it really done somewhere explicitly?
There's a part. It's well understood in two dimensions.
In 2D, yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
and in three dimensions, a part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in 2D, it's well understood because all these measures are symplectic measures.
Yeah.
But you know, all the theorems you were mentioning before, even the equivalence with the moduli space and the p gamma, stuff, as far as I understand, it's really understood only in 2D. I mean, it's kind of a folk theorem that it's true in higher dimension, but I don't know any paper that prove it outside the 2D case, outside the case where you have another measure which is a symplectic measure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is some literature in three dimensions in this case of having defects.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we can look at it. There's a series of papers of Acher and also by Schwartz. And I don't know if there's a general statement for any kind of boundary, but in case of non-trivial topologies, this is a theorem.
So the statement is that in general, the Fadier proof of construction which we get is the analytical torsion.
Yeah.
And then if you use, and that this is the Riedemann torsion, and you know the Riedemann torsion is also something we get there.
Yeah.
I don't know if, okay.
It's not generally.
Have you done it explicitly, or is it?
Sorry?
Have you done it explicitly, or?
It's oh no! I not done the proof. What I did when I saw this the first time, I thought this is complicated. I'm gonna study it in a simple case. Yeah. It works well, and then I asked.
So this is a conjecture, which is saying that this is the equivalent.
And then I asked, and it seems that there's a lot of literature on this in three dimensions with non-trivial topology.
Yeah, but it might not be exactly, it's more conjecture at this stage.
I don't have the precise statement. I don't have the precise statement of this equivalence. I know that it holds for manifolds, three-dimensional manifolds with non-trivial topology and locally flat connections. The part that is a conjecture is if it holds for manifolds that have also boundaries. Mm-hmm. I know that there's a proof for manifolds with non-trivial topology. I don't know of a proof in the case where there are boundaries, because it depends on the boundary conditions that we're putting. So I would say I agree it's a conjecture in the case with boundaries. Okay, so the second part is about the dynamics. In a way, this is familiar. This is not new at all. This is the way I've been thinking of spin forms. new thing is that I'm always starting from something continuous, from a field theory, and then getting the discrete version, the version with a finite number of degrees of freedom. So I'm going through describing something familiar in spin forms, that is, at the classical level, you can describe general relativity as a topological theory with constraints. When you impose topological theory of the BF type, with B constrained to be of this form. When you impose this constraint everywhere in the manifold, you unfreeze an infinite number of degrees of freedom. You get GR. Now, you can define another theory, a diff invariant theory that has a finite number of degrees of freedom, doing the following. You don't impose this constraint everywhere, but only on some two-dimensional defects. The construction is the same as the one I did in three dimensions, but in four. Decomposition of the four manifold in cells, erase the two skeleton of this decomposition, and impose the constraint only on these defects, on these two skeleton. So now you get that the field strength is supported on the defect surfaces. So this is a truncation of general relativity that is diff invariant.
Yeah. Are those two statements, one that the B constraint is imposed only on the two skeleton, and that the F is supported on the two skeleton, those are separate statements? Or one implies the other?
They are equivalent. Well, not equivalent. This implies F. There's
given the equations of motion. It implies it given what? Because the equations of motion are different depending on whether you...
Yeah, so I describe it this way. If you don't constrain B, you get an equation of motion tells you that F is zero.
Right.
Okay. And we are not putting any constraints on B in the bulk. So F is zero everywhere in the bulk. The only place where we are putting constraints on B is on these surfaces. So there F is not imposed to be zero. Still, there are constraints on F.
Very good. Can you express this in some consistent way by writing an action with the Lagrange multiplier, the uniform with the phi Lagrange multipliers, and having phi just have support?
This is a way to formulate it. This is a way to formulate it. You say that the Lagrange multiplier has support on the defects. Another way to formulate it is to say you impose, so I'm saying there's a bulk and a boundary. The boundary is this defect network. And you impose boundary conditions on B, on the defect network. You say B cannot be generic there. That's to satisfy some constraints equivalent to that. And in fact, this is the way I want to define my quantum theory, because this is a classical theory. I can quantize that integral method in this way. If I don't impose this constraint on B, I just get a topological theory. Now I'm imposing the constraint only on the boundary of this manifold with defects. And even if spin forms are generally not formulated in this way, what is done is, in a very precise sense, equivalent to this. In fact, what we do in spin forms is to start from BF theory and impose conditions on these two-dimensional effects. Yes.
But again, this is with a fixed two-skeleton.
It is a two-skeleton that can go from a certain space network of defects to a certain different network of defects. Yeah. Yeah. So this is a theory with finite number of degrees of freedom, and the question is, how do you get infinitely many? I'm just describing this sector here. So I think... Okay. So I think... there's no real need to go through the standard derivation of spin forms. I can just mention it quickly. I don't have a derivation that is field theoretical. I'm just recalling basic things about spin forms, the way we understand them today. It's very close to what I've been presenting. I'd like to have a top-down derivation. Now, here I want just to show that the structure that we have now is very close to this formulation. The structure that we have now is... if you want that B, assume that B satisfies the constraint of being of this form as a function of the tetrad. then from this it follows that if you could decompose B in terms of the space parts, rotations, and boosts, these components satisfy a constraint that is the linear simplicity constraint. In spin forms, what people are doing is to take these as the constraints that you are imposing on the defect network. So what you do in the quantum theory is to start with a topological theory, a BF theory, the one studied by Oguri. This you know how to quantize it on a cellular decomposition. And has 0 degrees of freedom or finite number if the manifold does not trivial topology. But now you impose this constraint on the two skeleton of the cellular decomposition. And this is a way to unfreeze curvature degrees of freedom on the two skeleton. And you impose this in the following way. When you, if I go back here in this path integral on the cellular decomposition, you can describe it in a Fourier transform in terms of representation of your space-time group, Lorentz group. And now this constraint on B is imposed as a restriction on representations. So in a precise sense, this is imposing constraints on the B field. In a technical sense, this is imposing constraints on the B field, on the defect network. Would be nice to have a top-down derivation starting from the path integral computing functional measures. It is not what is done now. Okay, so some remarks. The first thing that I'd like to discuss is what is the relation to other approaches. In fact, this is something familiar in many ways. In fact, in a precise sense, it's a generalization to four dimensions of what is done in 2+1 dimensions. But in 2+1 dimensions, gravity with point particles is well understood both at the classical and the quantum level. And the question is, do the methods developed there are useful for four-dimensional quantum gravity? And it seems here in this description that we are really boosting those methods to four dimensions. We are going from point defects to line defects using the same methods. And the surprise for me is that we are not getting a new quantum theory. We are getting loop quantum gravity. There's another approach that has been recently proposed by Toft. It is very similar. And he calls it a finite model of gravity. It consists in considering scattering of straight pieces of string surrounded by locally flat sections of space-time. Now, this is a classical theory, a finite number of degrees of freedom, and one can ask if one can quantize it. At first sight, this looks like just as regular gravity with a piecewise flat matrix. The new thing is that there's the local gauge group, this local Lorentz group, that plays a central role. So again, you have an improvement with respect to the regular formulation. That is, you can use group theoretical methods. And this what he is trying to do, that is determine the dynamics just looking at the scattering of these defects with junctions that are locally Lorentz invariant. And another approach I'd like to mention is the one by Bites, Feilbein, and Peretz. Some time ago, they considered a BF theory coupled to matter, coupled to string-like matter. And it turns out that you can quantize it and get something very close to loop quantum gravity with these extra degrees of freedom. Here, we are looking at these defects not as matter-supported defects, but as gravity itself. But the mathematics is very similar. OK. So all this is a finite number of degrees of freedom. But in fact, we want to deal with an infinite number of degrees of freedom. And one of the motivations is that if you start with one of these Hilbert spaces with a moduli space of a certain dimension, spin forms send you from one of them to one with a different dimension, to a different Hilbert space. So the dynamics by itself changes your Hilbert space. And so this suggests that we should consider a larger Hilbert space that we can define a Lafock Yeah, the number is just the dimension of the moduli space, and taking the sum of them and completing them in norma, you get a Fock space that is separable, just like Fock space in quantum field theory. So in a precise sense, you can define a larger Hilbert space that corresponds to all the class, all possible defects in this way. This,
If one graph is a subgraph of the second graph, is the relationship between those two places?
Yeah, there is one, and in fact, this measure determined, field theoretical measure, automatically guarantees that if you impose that magnetic field is zero on some defect line, you reduce to the sub-Hilbert space where the defect line is not there.
Right, so it's not a Fock space, it's not a direct sum.
Yeah, it is if you subtract the zero modes. Okay, second comment is about the notion of locality. You know that in a topological field theory, you have only global degrees of freedom, but here there's something new. There's this network of defects that give a finite number of degrees of freedom that are associated to regions of the manifold. You consider a region, this contains a finite number of defects, and you can think of degrees of freedom associated to this region. And then the question is, what is the scale of this region? If you just restrict to the connection and to the topological theory, you don't have a scale. But here you know that the scale is coded into the momentum conjugated to the connection that has a discrete spectrum that sets the scale of the region when you say at which level you are. And there's something else that is interesting. You are not getting all possible spin network graphs. In this construction, in this particular construction, you are getting only the spin network graphs that are dual to triangulations or cellular decompositions. So in this sense, there are no non-local links. There are some graphs that are present in the full loop quantum gravity Hilbert space that here are not present. And in a precise way, this avoids the problem of locality pointed out by Marco Polo this morning. Is built into the theory that you don't have these states. Okay, so why, to me, this looks promising. It appears to me that this leads to a scenario of the following kind, a scenario where you don't have transplantian degrees of freedom because the theory is topological at small scale, but at larger scales, it has many degrees of freedom. These many degrees of freedom, the hope is that you can describe them in an effective way in terms of a local quantum field theory. And the intuition behind this is, to me, the intuition comes from this problem that you can find in Wendt's book. If instead of having just a single solenoid, now you have a grid of many solenoids, classically a charged particle would go straight, not see the solenoids at all. But quantum mechanically, if the wave function is a support that is large enough to see many solenoids, you would have that the momentum gets deflected in a way that you can compute classically, just averaging this singular distribution of magnetic fields and give a uniform magnetic field in this region that is not vanishing everywhere but has the same flux. So the picture is you have this distributional connection, wouldn't give any effect classically, but if you probe it only at larger scales with respect to the scale given by the defect network, you could not distinguish it from a singular curvature distribution. Okay, I'll conclude here. This is my summary. Given a dual formulation of loop gravity that is not in terms of spin networks and spin forms, but in terms of a local field theory with topological defects. this derivation, this gives a derivation of the functional measure of loop quantum gravity via quantum field theory methods, and gives a new light on the main technical assumption of loop gravity. Yeah, that I'd like to state it this way. The microscopic degrees of freedom of classical and quantum loop gravity are gravitational connections with distributional magnetic fields supported on defects. And I'll stop here. Thank you very much for the attention.
Are there more questions?
Okay, shall I ask the question?
Mm-hmm.
So if you've shown that the Hilbert space of quantum gravity is related to a direct sum of Hilbert spaces, each of which is a quantization of the degenerate set of connections and plane fields, then have you shown that the quantum gravity quantizes completely the degenerate sector and doesn't have general relativity? That is, you take advantage of the fact that the first order formalism has degenerate solutions and solutions which have support only in lower dimensional sets, which is not a property of general relativity, but it's a property of first order formulations like the Ashtapart formulation. The scary question about loop quantum gravity has always been, have we quantized the sector of the Ashtapart variables, which is not a sector of general relativity?
I understand the question. So clearly at the classical level, you would have these solutions where the metric is degenerate in the sense that it's zero everywhere except somewhere. But here we are not doing this. We are looking at the connection. I'm not saying that the magnetic field, the field strength of the connection is zero everywhere, it supports somewhere. So this is not telling much about the metric. In fact, it turns out that you can ask about the momentum conjugated to the connection. And we were discussing this with Laurent, he's working on this. It turns out that, this is a topological theory in the bulk outside the defects. And there you can ask, what is the metric? The metric is this electric field here, but it is behaving exactly as the B field of a BF theory. It is not defined unless you gauge fix the translational invariance. So this is telling us that we don't have a clear-cut notion of metric to scales below the scale of defects. But it's not telling us that the metric is degenerate. So I would say what we are quantizing is a classical theory with a finite number of degrees of freedom. It is singular, but it's not metrics that are zero almost everywhere. It's curvature that is zero almost everywhere.
If you turn down the cosmological constant, would you be doing sort of what Archimald wanted to do, which is having classical theory with this topological theory, but not where F is flat, but where F is proportional to B.
Mm-hmm.
And that would include locally anti-desiderative system.
Would be a different description from this, where you have still a topological theory where there's no defect, but where the field strength is non-zero. And I don't know if this is equivalent to any version of loop quantum gravity, if it's equivalent to loop quantum gravity with a quantum group or not.
What a mistaken impression that you end up with finite degrees of freedom, which is manageable, mm-hmm. basically because you start from fixing certain cellular decomposition and then your spin network appear as certain technical device which is doable at particular decomposition. But does it matter how you choose one which is preferred, or actually you have at the end also sum up overall possible ones, so overall possible classes?
That's exact. One is getting finite degrees of freedom because one is imposing them.
Yeah.
the constraint. And then you get spin networks as a description. So you get the quantum theory restricted to this, and the question is, can you complete to an infinite number of degrees of freedom?
It looks to me a bit like, yeah, we're getting like spin networks on a fixed graph.
Mm-hmm.
Normally we sum over all possible graphs. So
it would be a summing over.
You have all possible decompositions you start.
Yeah, would be a summing over all possible decompositions.
The analogy would be take field theory and now work with the truncation, which is a truncation where the number of particles, you know, or the number of particles is smaller than the given in the picture. In fact, this is a strict analogy. You can make, this is really a generalization of this truncation of field theory. And of course, when you write the whole dynamics, you have to include, you know, the fact that when you write, but you can still ask the question, okay, what is the S matrix element between two particles and four particles, you know, non-perturbative. So, you know, this is a very useful truncation.
It was more to understand how it fits in the bigger picture.
Yeah.
But it's a different, it's the same picture, but it's different because it clearly makes this, you know, I don't know, graph. You know, look exactly like the number of particles.
And to me, it looks like being a way to state the main assumption that is, I understand that every time you quantize a field theory, you do this. You first focus on a finite number of degrees of freedom and then you complete. For a imperturbative quantum field theory, you do this restricting to n particles, defining n particle sector, and then you complete to infinite number of particles. Or the other example is lattice gauge theory, where you first restrict the theory to a finite number of degrees of freedom on the lattice, and then you ask again the question, how do I complete the infinite number? So it's a way to define a quantum field theory.
So does this construction, the first half of your talk, the equivalence between the locally flat connections and the duality between the graph and the calculus, Does that have any generalization to a different gauge fixing for E? So if you fix locally E being constant curvature, for example, because loop quantum gravity admits those representations, where you have a vacuum expectation value for the metric sector for the fluxes. So is there a similar correspondence? I mean, I know in the mathematical literature, so from what I know about 2+1, I don't know those things about three dimensions. That's not answered there. Do you have any ideas?
No. And the reason is that here, I'm imposing these conditions always on the connection, never on the electric field, never on the metric.
Yes, but you calculate the electric field by taking the holonomy loop around some region, and then you have to flux through this surface.
Turns out that the electric field is not gauge invariant.
No, the electric field is not gauge invariant, but you can form gauge invariant quantities. Like the metric observables.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you ask an area, for example, that is a gauge invariant quantity.
Yeah.
So then you have these representations of loop quantum gravity where the metric or where the area of a surface takes a finite vacuum expectation value. And then you have on top of that you have these excitations that you would call topological excitations. I have just a bunch of punctures that goes through the surface in addition to the vacuum expectation value.
Yeah, and yeah, I would give the same picture for the connection, but not for the metric. I think here you don't have a metric that is locally flat.
You're just imposing A is locally flat,
yeah.
and that doesn't change anything.
Yeah.
But that you, then you just have the same picture. You just have to add always this vacuum expectation value to everything when you. Okay, that makes sense.
Okay.
It's even more than that. E is not defined unless you put the monomer. Because it's the area observable is not invariant in the translation gauge signature. So it doesn't commit with the constraint F equal to zero. So it doesn't exist. It's not defined in this understanding. So yeah. And that's a picture where the geometry, you know, really arises only when you coarse grain. Before that, there's no notion of a definite geometry. There's just a notion of equivalence class of geometry.
Okay, then then that contradicts what you were just saying.
No? Yeah. So if you ask, what is the electric field here? Is it constant everywhere? Is it zero everywhere?
No. I wanted to understand this. Is there a connection with loop quantum gravity with the sector where you have a finite vacuum excitation wave? So this condensate of quantum geometry states. Is there, can you make a connection with those? Or is that just under, you have to impose coarse graining and then, like you said from Ben's book, you absorb all those fine solenoids or all those fine,
I think you should require coarse graining.
Okay, before that, you cannot.
Before that, if you ask about the electric field, there's a part that is fully gauge invariant. It is the one that I was giving in terms of momenta conjugate to the moduli. Yeah. This P. These are gauge invariant, so the geometric observables are to be written in terms of them. But if you want to recover the E field and ask if it's constant or it's zero, then the E field depends on P, on the momentum conjugate to the moduli, and on the gauge. And this E field is exactly as the B field. There's a translation symmetry makes it undetermined. Cannot ask if it's zero or if it's constant. It's both. Yeah. Still, there are quantities that are gauge invariant, that have a metric interpretation, and that should correspond to the volume and the area that we use in quantum gravity, as the volume of a node or the area a surface punctured by a link. But this doesn't mean that you can write it locally as the flux of this electric field and functions of the flux of this electric field. These are local functions that depend only on P. I think this is something new in our understanding of the geometry of quantum gravity. We generally start assuming that the E field is, for instance, continuous and smooth, so that if you look at a small region, you can approximate it with constant and define the volume assuming that it is constant.
But that's the purpose of the Jonathan
really
understanding what is the geometric concept.
Yeah.
Are there any more questions? If not, let's thank Virginio.